Welcome to Radio at Firehouse.com. Real issues, real answers, real firefighters. Firehouse.com brings you the leaders of the nation's fire, rescue, and EMS services, the top columnists and educators, and today's most important issues, headlines, and comments. Listen right on your desktop or download and listen on the go to Firehouse.com.
With less money and fewer firefighters, departments have to use their people in the smartest and safest ways. So the next time you're speccing an apparatus, think manual and remote control monitors. Why, TFT practically reinvented radio frequency handheld controls for monitors, flowing from 15 up to 2,000 gallons per minute. Since every firefighter counts, so does every purchase. We can help maximize your team's Firestream's performance today. Visit us at www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686.
Welcome to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at Firehouse.com. This is a January edition, the first show of 2008. Unfortunately, has a lot of breaking news. The headlines on the homepage of Firehouse.com for the last few days have been packed with incidents of apparatus overturns, apparatus being struck, firefighters operating vehicles while under the influence of alcohol, and we'll hear about that in just a second and some other topics. But first is a reminder to, if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please drop us an email to podcast@firehouse.com. And Happy New Year, Mike. Happy New Year, Tom. Thank you for joining us, and what are we going to be looking at today?
Great. Thanks, Peter. Today, here's today's rundown. We're going to talk about the first, on an upbeat note, some upcoming fire service events that, from a planning standpoint, you might want to consider making your reservations to go attend. The second one, as Brother Peter just alluded to, since the first of the year, it has been anything less than stellar in terms of how we're doing on a very, very serious note with apparatus accidents and crashes, and Mike is going to highlight some of those. We're then going to talk about what you need to consider or what's going to happen to you when your rig gets involved in some kind of accident. And we're talking about, as a result of the incidents that Mike's going to highlight, we're not talking about the little fender bender where you wrap, you know, your front bumper around a parked car. These are the big-time incidents, and unless you've got your proverbial house in order, you're going to be in a world of hurt. And that will bring us to a fourth topic, which is what some practical considerations of things that you can do to make sure that you don't get in an accident with your rig. And then as time allows, we're going to talk about a little bit of one of my favorite subjects, what really connotates an innovative fire truck. Awful lot of buzz about what people think that they purchased because they maybe spent more money than the next guy down the road. They bought something really innovative and unique, and whoever came up with the term history repeats itself was certainly a wise person. So before we turn it over to Brother Mike and start talking about some of the apparatus crashes, here's some things for planning purposes that you might want to think about attending here in the next month or so. First one coming up, the Fire Department Safety Officers Association in Orlando, Florida, which if you hail from New York like Mike and I do, not a bad time of year to get out of the cold winter months. They'll be down in Orlando between January 21st and the 23rd. To attend their apparatus symposium, which is, it's not a show. You don't go down here to kick tires and look at fire trucks. You go down to hear from industry experts in all different areas to talk about the design, the specification, and most importantly, the safety aspects of how to procure, buy, and maintain a fire apparatus. So that's the 21st, 22nd, and 23rd coming up in here in just a couple of weeks down in Orlando, Florida. Well, if Orlando's not your cup of tea, and another place that's absolutely a phenomenal location, and one that Mike and I have had the privilege of going out to instruct at for the last couple of years, is Firehouse World in San Diego, which is going to be coming up here from February 3rd for the first couple of days for hands-on training, and it runs the 3rd through the 7th right down at the Convention Center in San Diego, California. So even if you aren't a San Diego Chargers fan, it's a phenomenal show. For us East Coast guys, it's always a pleasure to go out and deal and talk to the brothers out on the West Coast. Great time of year to go out there. Some phenomenal instructors and speakers, not the least of which you can hear Brother Mike and I bazoo and talk about a couple of subjects that are on the agenda. And that, again, is February 3rd to the 7th. And then finally, one of the big kickoff shows where you not only get to hear and talk instructors and can do some hands-on training. But one of the first big major shows of the year where you can kick tires, slam doors, and look at apparatus is the Fire Department Instructors Conference, which is in Indianapolis, Indiana, again, and that is from April 6th through the 12th. So while we're here kind of in the dead of winter, at least up here in the northern part of the country, and not a lot of maybe good things to be looking forward to, there are three events that are absolutely, if you're into the apparatus world and responsible for the driving, maintaining, or specifying components, three excellent training opportunities to be able to advance yourself in your career. So now, having talked about that, Mike, every morning I get up, my wife goes to work, I fire up my laptop, and with the myriad of different internet news sources that I view over the course of the first half hour of my day each morning over my Starbucks, I'm finding that we're starting off this year on an absolutely horrific pace with a number of very, very serious apparatus accidents. So any kind of review and comment on that so far?
Yeah, Tom, it didn't take long. Within the first 8 hours of 2008, we had our first line of duty death in the fire service. And unfortunately, that was a driving event. A firefighter with the Oregon Hill Volunteer Fire Department was killed in a rollover crash while responding to a working house fire. It's located in Rockingham County, North Carolina. The gentleman was responding to this house fire in his POV, and according to officials on scene, he was driving too fast. He did not have a seatbelt on. He was in a pickup truck. He lost control. He rolled it over and was ejected from the truck and was killed instantly. And certainly our deepest sympathies from Firehouse Magazine, firehouse.com, and Mike and Tom and Pete all go out to that firefighter's family. But it didn't take long, and it's just been one wreck after another, it seems, since that time. In Virginia, a fire truck and a tractor trailer collided on January 2nd at about 3:30. And Tom brought up a good point with this accident. You can go to firehouse.com, and they actually have pictures of the truck there, and it looks like it's a fairly new Pierce. Was that a Pierce, right, Tom?
Yeah, that was a number of Pierces that particular department bought.
Yeah, and it just shows in the picture something that Tom and I have consulted with and have really wanted to put on apparatus are just the steel-reinforced bumpers. That particular crash really shows the value of having that particular addition onto your rig and the safety value that it provides for the cab and the crew. In Jacksonville, Florida, Engine 51 rolled over a couple days ago. A rookie firefighter is in critical condition. He had to be airlifted out. And unfortunately, he just graduated from the academy only a few weeks ago, and he was trapped for some time and had to be extricated. A firefighter in Bridgeport fell off of a van. I believe this is Bridgeport, Alabama. Was in a van, was getting some equipment out. Somebody didn't know that he was there and started there, or the van was started, I guess, and they put the van in drive, and he fell out, striking his head on the pavement. And he took a pretty hard lick, and I quote, two fire trucks collided in the North Hudson Regional Fire Department in West New York, New Jersey on January 2nd. Seven firefighters were hurt. A rescue truck collided with a pumper, and they were both responding to the same alarm. And we have a new feature here. It's going to be called the Headline of the Month. And right away, Tom, we have a tie by three, just absolutely horrendous. In the state of Maryland, there's an online edition of St. Mary's Today, a newspaper, and their headlines read, Fire Truck Demolition Derby, Cowboys or Firefighters? Waldorf keeps up with the Joneses in a fire truck rodeo action. They flipped a heavy squad on its side. The day after, another department flipped their heavy rescue on its side. And then another headline here, another aside, why are volunteer firefighters wrecking $500,000 pieces of equipment in dry, sunny weather? A pretty good question to be asking. That's certainly a disturbing headline. The next one has to do with trying to get the Michigan State vehicle and traffic law changed so that a group of people that are involved with animal care want to run red lights and sirens with spot and trigger onto the vet for those pets that are sick or injured. It would seem to me, just my opinion, that we have enough trouble in this country getting police officers and ambulances and fire trucks to the scene of emergencies to help people, let alone giving another whole group red lights and sirens. They are allegedly working with a state representative, Lisa Wojnow, and please, Lisa, for the sake of the emergency services industry, don't allow this to go on. We don't need any more people out there with red lights and sirens. It's hard enough to get around as it is. I'm an animal lover. I actually have four cats. But you have to draw the line somewhere, and certainly giving people license to run hot with animals in the back that could potentially, these 3,000 or 4,000 pound bullets could potentially kill your family or mine. And what kind of training is going to be provided for animal ambulance drivers, and what kind of regulations are going to be put in force? And none of that was really answered in this newspaper article. It was just, we want to go out and have red lights and sirens, and we're going to change the law to allow us to do that.
Mike, just a couple of comments. One, that I'm very happy to know that you as well as are an animal lover, and just thinking that if this legislation does pass, that possibly might be an opportunity for you as you finish in your waning years in your career in FDNY. If you wanted to remain active in the emergency service, I could certainly see you driving one of the ambulance medic units around in the state of Michigan. That might be a possible retirement job. But on the serious note, to go back to that headline that you mentioned, it was in that one online edition of St. Mary's. When things go bad for your department, and we'll be talking about this a little bit more later on in the podcast today, all of the good things that your department has done in the past, if we think about just coming out of the holiday season, you may have sponsored some Santa or holiday event at your fire station. You may have gone around and gifted underprivileged kids in the first due area, maybe helped out an unfortunate family that suffered a loss during the fire during the holiday season. All of that good stuff that you've done, not just for the last couple of weeks, but for years and years on end, when you find your department at the wrong end of an accident, and we're certainly not in any case alleging in the case of Waldorf or St. Leonard or Jacksonville or any of the other incidents that, that Brother Mike just mentioned, we're not here as judge and jury to say, here's what they were doing wrong. But to learn from these tragic events is that from a media standpoint, understand that your department is going to take a tremendous hit. Even if you have the world's greatest PIO to be able to take it and try to get the fire department side of the issue. Specifically to the brothers down in Waldorf, this one hits close to home. That particular rig, Squad 3, that flipped yesterday morning, was one that yours truly designed many years ago when I was employed with another apparatus builder. The Waldorf Fire Department is one where I have a lot of folks down there that I know personally. And that department responds to, with a all-volunteer force on the fire side, between two stations, last year responded to 4,645 runs, of which 876 of them were just for automobile accidents. Down there locally, they call them 1050 or 1050 PI for personal injury. So this department, you look at that headline that Mike just mentioned, you know, firefighters, are they out running around as cowboys? I can assure you, sitting here in Buffalo, New York, on Friday the 4th, not having any personal knowledge of the incident surrounding what caused Squad 3 to flip over, that fire department is not a bunch of cowboys down there. Yet, something really bad happened to them, and now that department is going to have to deal not only with the internal issues, but as well as the external issues of dealing with the media and the family and figuring out what they're going to do to get the rig fixed and a whole bunch of other stuff that if you don't have a plan in place, you know, most of us here in the emergency services, particularly for Brother Mike and myself. We always like to think that when we show up, the situation's going to get better, or when we take up from the incident and on the way riding back to the station, we've made the incident somehow better or mitigated it. And if you don't get there to the incident, which is what happened in the case of Waldorf and several of these other cases, we don't really do not only the incident any good, we're not doing ourselves any good. The statistics got rolled up just a couple days ago from all of the line of duty deaths and the injuries from 2007. And despite the efforts that have been put forth by many, many folks, starting with Mike Wilbur and then going on to folks like Chief Billy Goldfeder with his firefighterclosecalls.com and everything that gets put up on our firehouse.com, you sometimes have to sit back and take a sanity check and say, are we really making an impact and doing the right stuff? Because based upon my simple 8th grade math, looking at the LODD stats from last year, we still was almost 20, just shy of 23% of firefighters were killed responding to or returning from alarms. And you'd have to think, if we're not learning from our mistakes, folks, I'm not sure what we're going to be able to do in Mike's and my lifetime to really make an impact here on the fire service, to think that the day they slammed me in the ground, that we really left the fire service and our world a better and or safer place. I mean, we sometimes joke about the accidents and, you know, the, you can't make this story up. I'm watching TV the other night and still learned that the Writers Guild is still on strike. Yet you read some of these headlines every morning when you roll out of bed and you're like, you can't make this up. You just absolutely can't make these stories up. And yet, folks, to our listeners, this is happening every day. We're not even 96 hours into the new year, and we've already wrecked a whole bunch of fire trucks, injured some guys, and have just turned some poor fire departments' lives upside down. And we haven't even gotten through 7 days of 2008. So if this isn't a wake-up call to the rest of us to start acting a little bit more rational, and the next time you get behind the wheel of an emergency vehicle, start driving that unit like thinking that people are aiming for you, like they've got a laser light on the rig. It's about time we wake up and realize this is a damn serious business, and only by the will of the good Lord have we not killed a lot more firefighters here in the last 4 days. And with that, I'll get off my soapbox and turn it back over to Brother Mike. What else have you got here on your little headline list?
Well, I got the one last headline of the month. Fire engine driver drunk and caught with drugs. This occurred in North Versailles Volunteer Fire Department in Pennsylvania. The firefighter drove to a run where the sheriffs were also present. The sheriffs smelled alcohol on the breath of the firefighter that had just driven the apparatus to this particular run. And they gave him a field sobriety test, which he promptly flunked, which then caused him to search the firefighter, where they found a bag of cocaine. You just, like you said, Tom, it just gets curiouser and curiouser, but you just can't make some of these headlines up. So those are our three for a tie. We're going to try and do this each month, where we just come up with a headline or two that just absolutely just beats the band and just can't make it up. We take you now to Canada, where authorities caught up with a suspected and charged him with impaired driving. However, when firefighters were attending to the accident scene where they caught up, a car crashed into their fire truck, and that driver was charged with driving with impaired as well. And some sobering statistics about that I just read recently: if you were on the road between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m., Monday through Thursday, one out of every four cars or vehicles that pass you going the opposite direction, that driver is under the influence of something. And then what's really sobering is that if you drive on the roads between Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night, those same hours, 11 p.m. to 4 a.m., one out of two drivers coming towards you is under the influence of something. Going on. Another fire service DUI, a chief rolled his SUV in Vista, California, and he was arrested and accused of drunk driving after he crashed and rolled the command vehicle. while he was taking his children to school. And then a chief was accused of drunk driving and racing outside of Burlington, Maine. And then finally, federal agents broke up an Ohio drug distribution ring on Friday, arresting 12 people, including a fire lieutenant from the city of Cincinnati, who was part of a key part of that illegal drug operation. Do you think, Tom, that we need to get people in this business to go through some random alcohol and drug testing?
You know, Mike, I think, and we've talked about it before, if you look at what is going on in the rest of our society today, we are somewhat naive at best to think that whether we are a volunteer organization or a career organization, that whatever percentage of the populace is involved with taking legal or illegal substances, sometimes in great excess, to think that those people are not, in some case, members of our own organization. So with that, we need to, like you say, you know, get our own house in order. But let's put the positive up front here. What different things can we do as emergency responders to try to improve the odds that we are not going to have an accident? Obviously, we're not going to always reduce and completely eliminate the opportunities, but there probably are some things we can do to at least minimize those chances that we're going to have. And some of these Mike and I have spoken about in the past, but they probably certainly bear repeating. And I guess one of the things that starts out with something that Mike Wilbur is probably the national authority on this is emergency vehicle operation and training. And I guess in my world, I go back many, many years ago to having attended a seminar that past Chief Alan Bruincini put on from the Phoenix Fire Department, and I will take Chief Bruincini's words with me to the grave because it made a great impact on me. When I was much younger and a little bit of a hotshot firefighter, I just thought that, you know, I kind of like knew everything, and when somebody screwed up, you know, the way to correct that screw up was to jump all over them, yell and scream, berate them, and they kind of like learn their lesson. You know, going back to the old days of parochial school education, when your handwriting was bad like mine was, I would get my knuckles whacked. Now, I never figured out in later life how bloody knuckles were going to help your handwriting, but that was the punishment that the good sisters in St. Margaret's or Pearl River would delve out. Well, Chief Bruincini made a comment that said, when somebody screws up on the fire ground, he said, the routine question you should ask is, who trained him to do that? And think about that for a moment. The person made a mistake. We want to go blame the person, or let's look at what training was made available to that individual, male or female, young or old. Doesn't make any difference what ethnicity the person is. If the person screwed up and didn't meet the performance criteria or the department's expectations, or fell way out of line and didn't follow the SOGs, we want to go back and blame the individual? Or let's say, what kind of training did that person get to put him in that role that made him susceptible potentially to fail? So with that, first thing on Brother Mike's and Tom's list is, let's talk for a few seconds about driver training and annual refresher training for emergency vehicle operators. Michael, if I was blessed to drive a fire truck back in 1995, you think I'm still good in 2008, or you think maybe they want to set me down and maybe have to do the cones in the parking lot again?
Well, many departments, unfortunately, Tom, that do have entry-level training programs, for whatever reason, seem to grant their operators a license for life. And you, being very intimately involved with building of the apparatus, know all too well how technologically advanced that they've become and how different a fire truck that's built in 2007 is compared to one that was built in, say, 1997 even. And so there are a lot of changes. The laws change, things change, people change, attitudes change. And in order to keep abreast with those changes, if you go to NFPA 1451, which is a risk management standard for driving, they will tell you that you need to have an annual refresher for your drivers, and then every 3 years you need to have a heavyweight come in from out of town, me or somebody like me that has a passion for this kind of training, and come in and kind of give a sanity check to the troops, as you would say, and get their foot off the accelerators and get them back on the brakes a little bit. And this training has to be ongoing. And I know my own department, the FDNY, struggles with this. A couple years ago, we actually did refresher training for our drivers that went over rather well. But again, it's all about budget dollars and overtime and training dollars. And a lot of times it becomes a fiscal event rather than a training event. And we haven't been able to have a recertification in the last year or two. But that program was, by most accounts, really, really successful. And then there are departments that, quite frankly, I got a call from a department, one of the larger departments in the country, where they don't have any driver training at all. And I said, well, where do you get drivers from? Well, we have 11 guys that generally drive, or 11 firefighters that drive in each of the companies. And when one of those guys or gals gets promoted or retires, we ask the next person if they want to learn to drive, and we train them in-house. And that's fraught with danger, because those people that are trained in-house are being trained by people that are not professional trainers. And what bad habits have they managed to amass in their driving careers that they're going to pass on to the new driving recruits? So it's just a system that's flawed right from the start. It's a recipe for disaster, and there's just no replacement for a proper training program and recertification program.
And what's going to happen is, if you get involved, and not that Mike has had an incident where he's been involved, but Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the first things that's going to happen, if you, as an emergency vehicle operator, get involved at an accident, they're certainly going to ask you to produce your license, at the very least. And if there's some incident where there's significant property and or, God forbid, personal injury, the attorney representing the client is probably going to want to be delving into your training records to see how experienced and what kind of training you've had. So let's take my little scenario. I get involved with a minor fender bender and run over Mrs. Brown's Toyota coming back from a run on Sunday, as Mrs. Brown is exiting church, and I run over her car. Nobody's hurt, but I do about $8,000 of damage to her little Toyota, and notice it as sparks start coming out of the underneath of the rig as I'm driving down a road. When a cop goes to pull me over, what's going to happen to me?
Well, the first thing that's going to happen is that, depending on the jurisdiction, you may go under right away a field sobriety test, and then you may be asked to give blood. And for those of us that drive apparatus, if you get in an accident, don't take that as a negative. If you have nothing to hide, you want to give your blood, and you want to go through the test so that it doesn't come up later, well, you know, those firemen, they drink all the time, and that guy was drunk. No, I wasn't. Here's my blood test. Here's my field sobriety test, and I was fine. And then the next thing, like you alluded to, is that you have to surrender your license. And one of the things that we constantly teach and train people, when you drive, whether as a volunteer, which you once you put your hand up in the air and say, I do, the volunteer part of being a volunteer is over. You are now, by law, you are an employee of that municipality or fire district or fire company or whatever jurisdiction has power over you. And what you are doing then is taking your personal driving license, and as part of a condition of that employment, again, whether you get a paycheck or not, you are lending your license to that municipality or that jurisdiction so that you can drive the truck. But make no mistake about it, it is your license. And if anything goes wrong, yeah, is the fire department going to get sued, or the fire district or the city? Absolutely. But it's also going to be you. It's your license. And I marvel at times when I've been on trucks and the guys in the back are banging on the window, come on, we got to get in there, we got to be first due. And then, you know, you realize that it's this poor guy's license. And what's interesting, when we talk about tractor-drawn aerials, you may be a terrific front-end driver and may not have such a good rear-end driver, tillerman, but yet in most states, in fact, in all of them that I'm aware, there are no provisions for tillermen. And so that if you get in an accident with a tractor drawn and you are driving the front, but it's not really your fault, the tillerman maybe flung the trailer out and whacked the car, again, you're allowing the tillerman to drive on your license, and that's a chargeable accident that's going to be charged to you because you're an affront. And that's how the system works. And you mentioned before about just the agony involved in this whole process, and a couple things come to mind. Just this past week, the fire apparatus driver and the officer on board the Baltimore City fire apparatus that collided in December with a civilian vehicle, an SUV at an intersection, and killed the three civilians on board. The apparatus operator and the officer were suspended without pay earlier this week from Baltimore City, and this is just going to start a litany of pain and review and basically taking that operation and putting it under a microscope. Those poor folks are in for a long haul, and not that anybody can explain away driving over a civilian vehicle and killing three civilians, but my heart certainly goes out to the firefighter and the crew there. And then, of course, it brings back your most recent comment from Chief Brunicini. You know, what kind of training did these folks have? Who trained them? How was the training? When was the last training? How important is driver training? Those are all questions that are certainly going to be answered in the days and weeks ahead, and it just is an absolute nightmare, just an absolute nightmare.
Well, we're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we're going to talk about some other things that you need to have to be able considerations, the things to do to help yourself avoid these tragic accidents that we've been discussing so far.
Help me out here. TFT has the industry's broadest line of fire suppression equipment, yet everyone thinks we're just nozzles. Sure, we've got all the fixed, selectable, and automatic handheld nozzles you'd ever want, but we also have great foam injection and application equipment, amazing manual and remote control monitors, high-flowing intake valves, and leak-proof suction hose. So if you're specking a new apparatus, go to www.tft.com or give us a call at 800-348-2686. TFT makes over 2,300 products. We're not just nozzles anymore.
Welcome back to the Apparatus Architects here on radio at firehouse.com. Right before we get into the second half of the show, I would just also like to thank the sponsor for this podcast, and that's Task Force Tips. You can learn more about them by clicking on the two ads on the podcast player page or by going to tft.com. Mike and Tom, what else do you have for us today?
Pete, thanks. And again, Mike and I are very appreciative to all the support that Task Force Tips has shown for our program and for supporting the fire service in general. Just great folks making very good products, and we're very thankful to have them to be part of our group. Turning though back to some things you can do to not eliminate, but maybe minimize the opportunities where you're going to be involved in some of these accidents, or things that you should at least have in place to verify that you were doing the right stuff. We've already talked about before the break about training, not only initial driver training, but refresher training and how to manage that. The next one might seem a little bit more innocuous, but in a lot of cases, when you analyze what caused the root cause of the accident or how these vehicles ended up being in the location where they were, was that they got lost and they weren't sure where they were going, and then they felt like they had to speed up to be able to get there so they wouldn't find themselves being out of position, or, God forbid, your third due engine and you find yourself actually showing up to be the fourth or fifth piece on the fire ground because you didn't take the quickest line from point A to point B. So these are pretty basic things, but it's familiarization with the first due area. If you're a driver, you ought to be knowing your first due and second due area cold, or as one of my former employers used to say, dead nuts. You ought to have that first due area pretty well memorized and not have to rely upon a GPS device to get there unless you're traveling more than 5 or 6 miles away. And that can be accomplished through a variety of sources. Old school, the old three-ring mapbook binders that were still in use today in many, many departments, showing not only the streets but the complexes where the 100-block breaks are, where sprinkler or standpipe connections are, where hydrant locations. More recently now, since many departments have their apparatus that are equipped with laptop computers and are CAD dispatched, they can actually have the maps on there which show your route to make sure that you're going in the right direction. But if you don't know how to get there and your biggest decision of the day after what time you're going to have coffee or what time you're going to put the chairs up in the kitchen and start doing your housework becomes when you clear the station ramp, geez, Lou, am I going left or right? If you find yourself in that position asking and you don't know how to get there, maybe you ought to learn the area before they put you behind a wheel and you start blowing people off the streets with your lights and siren. Sounds kind of simple, but in many cases you'll find people were frankly ignorant and didn't know the area or where they were going.
That's more important now, Tom, because of all the new recent development, particularly in the great Southwest and out on the West Coast and even some areas of the Northeast here. My own area here is just growing leaps and bounds with new developments and new streets, and we really need to keep abreast of those changes, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you have a township or in your location in many of these places with the planning boards or have folks that are in the GIS division that can keep you updated on new streets, new subdivisions, and when things are happening, you don't want to be finding out about them the first time that the communication center bangs out a box alarm for a location and everybody in the station is looking at one another like, geez, we better go to the map and go find out where that is. And I can cite firsthand a good example. Quick little war story within the last month, happened to be in a fire station where they put out a call for a gas leak in an adjacent town, and they didn't have any map books, and the first thing they did is at least they were smart enough to go look at the map, you know, old style pull down map in the watch desk area to find out where they were going. But it was in the next community over. Well, maybe there's an excuse there, but again, as they would say, ignorance of the law is no excuse. If you don't know where you're going, chances are you're not going to have a very successful and/or safe run. That brings us to the next thing. You need to have your vehicles inspected. Depending upon local or state regulations, it certainly is at least annually, as well as other preventative maintenance. But if you find yourself involved in a serious wreck, that's one of the things that they're going to be looking at is when was the vehicle inspected. If it was a really serious incident, we go back to the Waterbury incident, tragic incident, two pieces of apparatus that struck one another, and there ultimately was a fatality as a result of that. If the vehicle has any type of sordid inspection history, hasn't been inspected, if your vehicle happens to be overweight in any capacity or has otherwise been mechanically deficient, Mike, I'm thinking you're at the wrong end of the law here.
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. And it's become my favorite new saying, it doesn't matter until it matters. And what happens is that many departments are under this illusion that although the state police aren't coming into the station scaling their trucks every day or they're not getting stopped at roadblocks, that they don't necessarily have to adhere to the law. What generally happens is that you can drive an overweight fire truck down the road and nobody's much is going to care as long as you keep it on all the wheels and you don't hit anything. But that's not the case here. Once you hit particularly somebody else or damage somebody else's property, that becomes a problem then. It becomes very problematic where you get somebody else's attorney involved and they start investigating, and it just triggers a whole bunch of grief, really. If you get in a single vehicle accident, maybe you get a free pass on that when nobody is much going to care. But it's when you hit somebody or something and hurt somebody or damage somebody's property, that's when the troopers are going to come out. The first thing, you may be under the mistaken impression that the weight of your truck doesn't matter because it's a fire truck and you feel like maybe you might be exempt, and that might be all well and good until you have this event. And then the first thing that you're going to find is the state police are going to scale the truck. It's going to be quarantined for this investigation, and that's going to be one of many charges that are going to be leveled against you, the driver.
And that kind of goes to our next issue of knowing the vehicle weights. And if you're an emergency vehicle operator and you don't know, let's even go beyond weights. And this normally comes and shows up on firehouse.com at least once a year, when somebody goes to back a vehicle in to maybe not their own station, but somebody else's station and find out that the vehicle was higher than what the station door was, or they submarined it under an underpass. You need to know, as an emergency vehicle operator, the principal dimensions of your unit. You know, most fire trucks are 8 feet wide or thereabouts. They range all over in terms of the height And if the vehicle height is not posted in the vehicle, if you don't know about it, if you're in an unknown area, you want to know that. You want to know how much the vehicle weighs. If it's overweight on the front or rear axle, as Mike just alluded to, when the vehicle gets impounded, you're not going to see that vehicle for a long, long time, even if it was only minimally damaged. You need to make sure that your tire pressures are appropriate for the load the vehicle carries. If you're not sure, it's normally right on the side as to what the maximum rating in pounds of carrying capacity on each tire at a particular inflation pressure. And if you're carrying less than that, then you need to adjust the tire pressure appropriately. If you're not sure, check your maintenance manual or contact the tire manufacturer. These are all real basic things for our listeners, but it's amazing to find out the number of fire trucks that are out there that we've sadly missed the mark. As much as has been written on the subject of having members seated and belted at all times during an emergency response and returning from alarms, the reason why some members have walked away from these accidents that we've talked about recently and others have had to be transported or have experienced serious injuries is because they were not seated and belted. This topic has been beat up and we've talked about it at length, and yet we still find brother and sister firefighters injured because they're not seated and belted, or they don't have all equipment properly secured inside the cab. We all know that if you're in a busy company and you're running 15, 20 calls a day in a busy ladder company, it's a pain in the neck to have to open up that compartment wherever you store it and grab the can, grab the 6-foot hook, grab the irons or the rabbit tool or whatever you're responsible for carrying in, and dutifully following the lieutenant or captain into the building. It's a lot easier to throw that crap on the floor of the cab and do your running, and at the end of the tour, have the next brother come in and go, hey, your irons and the rabbit tools right there at the hydro ramp, go have at it. Equipment that is not properly secured inside a compartment with an FPA-approved bracket that's capable of carrying that equipment and stored safely, or Mike and I have both seen equipment where the bracketry was in the cab, but yet it was still easier just to have it laying on the floor. These devices, equipment, and components become missiles when they're not properly secured. Think about these two rescue trucks in the state of Maryland that flipped over on their side. Think about if you have a vehicle like that, all the equipment that you store inside that vehicle, where in the walk-in part of the body, is it secured? Is it bolted down, or is it just sitting up on a deck and you're relying upon gravity and Mother Nature to hold it in place? These are some of the things you need to critically look at your apparatus to make sure that in the unlikely event, if you do have an accident, that the members are going to be able to walk away safely from this. And then our last two points that Mike and I would like to talk about, and we'll let Mike briefly elaborate on them, is stopping at intersections and lights, and no matter where you are, whether it's a bright sunny day, it's raining or snowing, no matter what the conditions are, windy or not, we need to be able to adapt our driving techniques to drive for the conditions. And that sounds pretty simple, but it's incredible to me that in many of the fire truck meetings that I do, we spend more time talking about how fast the vehicle can go and how many horsepower the engine should be than worrying about having other safety-related devices on the vehicle that may help us when the vehicle starts to go into a slide or unexpected movement that would otherwise cause us a little bit of consternation. So, Mike, at the stopping at intersections and lights and the driving for the conditions, any comment or review on that?
Yeah, although in any given year, Tom, intersection collisions may not make up the majority of all of our collisions, for sure, as far as it relates to lives lost, both civilian and firefighter, and property damage, they by far are the costliest in terms of lives and dollars. We constantly teach, we plead for people driving fire apparatus to stop. The NFPA wants you to stop. I want you to stop. In state law, the law says in most states that the apparatus operator can go through a steady red light or a flashing red light or a stop sign after slowing down as may be reasonably necessary for safe operation. So it gives the apparatus operator a little leeway, or there's a gray area there. But the reality is, in order to do this safely now, you really need to come to a full and complete stop. You go on the internet to YouTube, and Minneapolis, Minnesota had a tower ladder there that came within inches of striking an SUV that was caught on film. We have a department, a driver in Illinois, that just absolutely blew through a red light and then tried to send an email along trying to justify that decision. There's just no excuse to blow through red lights and stop signs. The ends don't justify the means, and it's one of those instances. There are no EVOC cops. There's not going to be somebody out there to say, hey, whoa, you can't do that, unless you have a really good officer corps that's willing to take that chance and to speak up, realizing the brotherhood and just the, you know, what's occurred with tradition and time and just part of the psychology of this business. You realize that there's nobody there saying no. And so you find that young driver that first breaks in, and he goes on that run, the first run, maybe 30 miles an hour. Well, a couple years go by, his brain shrinks, some other physical parts grow, and all of a sudden he's going 40 miles an hour on that same run that he wouldn't have thought of going over 32 the first few runs that he took when he first started to drive. And as time goes on, a couple years pass, more complacency sets in, more experience, no recertification, that certainly would fall into this category as well. And now we have that same person doing that same run at 50 miles an hour. And then a couple years later, that same person is crossing over double yellow lines, going around curves on the wrong side of the road. And it's generally at about the 8 or 10 year mark where this driver gets into what we call the big one. And that's that horrific intersection crash where we're crashing with civilian vehicles or we're crashing with other apparatus that sends people to the hospital or maybe even to the morgue and creates just an absolute disaster. And there's many causative factors, but if we just follow the tenets of emergency driving and just stop at intersections, that would relieve a lot of it.
Well, and those are all really good points, Mike, and things that, again, these concepts need to kind of be ingrained not only into the emergency vehicle operator, but into the organization. Again, it goes back, and it pains me greatly to start seeing and reading, you know, press comments and things referring to us in the fire service, and us is everybody. I don't care where you are, you know, from the southern tip down in the Keys of Florida up to the northern part up in North Star, Alaska, start referring to us and alluding to the fact that we're cowboys out there on the street. But this safety concepts and these types of thoughts need to be ingrained into the organization so that it's just part of something that we do every day. Because if you don't do these things and then your vehicle does get in a crash, we'll wrap up with talking about a few things that your organization needs to consider. Through many efforts of individuals here in the country, certainly a lot of fine efforts by the National Fallen Firefighters Foundation, that with your department is tragically experiences a line of duty death, there are some resources that the fire service has within our own organizations to be able to help the department through that traumatic period. But if you get involved with a serious vehicle crash, you're kind of left on your own volition to figure out what needs to be done. One of the first things that's going to happen is you have to have concern for the members, for the people that were injured, for the firefighters, and for the crew that was on that rig, and for some of the post-traumatic stress problems that are going to develop as a result of the accident themselves. Additionally, you're going to then have to think about our larger membership, the membership within the department, and what is going, the feedback, and some of the things that are going to happen there. If I've driven for Lieutenant Wilbur for 12 years, he's probably got a fair amount of confidence in my abilities to drive him around. If I have a big crash the second time that I'm driving for Lieutenant Wilbur, I'll bet he's not going to be too confident the next time that our tours and the stars happen to align and he looks over to the left and says, aren't you the guy that just crashed here the last tour? So, Mike, there's some psychological issues here, things that go on just forget about the outside world, but just within the fire department, right?
Yeah, absolutely, Tom. Once you get in one of these horrific wrecks, you have joined a club that nobody in the fire service ever wants to join. There was an excellent article that was written by retired Chief Gary Brown from Bowling Green, Kentucky, that appeared in Firehouse Magazine in 1994 under my column heading that was entitled Nobody Wins. And in that, it really chronicled in about a 10-page article what had happened to him after he got in a very serious crash. He hurt somebody. He almost killed them. The girl that was struck by his fire truck ended up critically hurt with a brain injury that really left her with a fifth-grade learning ability as to this day. For many days, it was unsure whether she would even survive or not. And here is a gentle, kind man who really was well-trained and who did everything right. And still, by being well-trained, having all the records, and doing everything right, it can still turn out all wrong, which, in fact, it did for him. He took a fit of drinking on. He almost got divorced. His wife ended up with a nervous breakdown. His family life was in turmoil for the better part of 4 years while the lawsuit and all the other ascendry things surrounding this event took place. And I have had the awesome responsibility of talking with and helping to counsel many firefighters that have been in these wrecks. And your lives are ostensibly ruined forever. And there's this old adage that says, time heals all wounds. And I just don't believe that after speaking with these firefighters, because although time makes their lives markedly better over time, as time passes, that their lives are really ruined and their lives will certainly never be the same again. So it's a tremendous psychological toll. And it's one, if you think about it, as a civilian driver, you can go and hit somebody and kill them, and it's not going to have the same effect as if a firefighter does it. And why? Because we take this Hippocratic oath to save lives and protect properties. And so when we take a life in the performance of our duty, it's just an emotional and psychological burden like no other. And in some cases, there was a case years ago, a little war story, where a firefighter ran over a car in upstate New York and killed four people in it, and he was actually ostracized from his community. And at about the two-year mark, he sat out on his front porch, and he took a shotgun to his head and killed himself. So the psychological part of this, getting in a major accident, can really be severe.
And it goes beyond then, Mike, to pick up on that. We have our own fire service family within the department. You then have the members' families themselves that are obviously very concerned. If you're in an organization, volunteer, career, get involved in a serious accident where now you're placed out of work, while you may be getting disability insurance from whatever particular insurance coverage is available to you, you find yourself that in many cases that does not cover the family expenses and doesn't come close to covering the expenses that you would be able to have as a result of getting your normal, you know, compensation for that job if you happen to be in a career department. Additionally, as we've talked about briefly, you then have to deal with the media. And if your fire department doesn't have a public information officer, or maybe an actually officially, you know, anointed PIO, you need to get someone that can speak intelligently to the media so you don't experience some of this slanderous coverage that you found that, you know, Mike mentioned on this one website where they come up and they show pictures that were taken by the local news agencies of two rescue trucks from Southern Maryland on their side and automatically paint everybody down there as cowboys, and why are these guys wrecking $500,000 fire trucks? You know, it's one of the things that makes our country great is the freedom of speech guaranteed by the First Amendment. But on the other hand, that puts us sometimes in a negative posture that we are automatically judged as being guilty in the fire service, and we have to prove ourselves to be innocent rather than innocent until proven guilty. And unless you have at least someone, whether it's the elder statesman in a department or someone that can speak very eloquently or speak on behalf of the fire department and act as the intermediary, if you're in a volunteer organization and you're thinking the fire chief is getting the members back to health, contacting their loved ones to let them know that husband or brother have been injured, but everything's okay, and arranging transportation to the hospital, and then worrying about, okay, well, now there's, who are we going to get to tow the rig out of now that it's on its side? And, oh, by the way, somebody called the insurance company, and they want, you know, to come in and take a look at it, and there's three people at the, hey, chief, when you get back to the fire station, there's a local TV outlet, and two of the newspapers are at the station, and they want somebody to make a statement. You kind of need to have that. It's like a pre-plan. We pre-plan for a lot of other things we do in the fire service. We don't necessarily pre-plan an event like this as to what's going to happen and who's going to take the forefront in all of those things.
I have a couple words of advice here. First, the fire chief should be the one that's going to speak for the department, and it would be my advice before the fire chief starts opening up his mouth and making comments that he has the best darn attorney in town standing right next to him. Many times apparatus operators, in a kind of a fit of guilt after having this calamity occur, want to go up to the police officer and try and explain their part of this. And a lot of times what occurs is that the police take things out of context. If the press happens to be listening in, they take things out of context. And the apparatus driver may actually be digging themselves a deeper hole in the hopes of trying to make this disaster better. In fact, they're just making it worse for themselves. So they really need to have either a PIO or the chief of department speaking for the department, and that person should have some legal counsel right by their side before they ever start to talk to the press.
Good comment, Mike. And just the last couple things to finish up here on this topic. You're going to have to think about if it's a special service unit, if it's a rescue truck, or if it's a ladder truck and it's the only one that you have in your community and it's going to be tied up for a couple of days, a week, or if it's involved, unfortunately, in a fatal accident, you could have that vehicle impounded and tied up for several months. You're going to have to make other arrangements to get backup coverage to cover the other incidents or alarms. If your department's not large enough, or even in a modest-sized city that might have three ladder trucks in service, you wreck one or two and you put the one spare in service and now you have no reserve unit, that comes down to critical mass, because now you got people showing up to ride a fire truck and might not have a fire truck for them to ride on. So you need to have some contingency plans laid out through either shared resources with other departments that can get you another unit or that will provide the proper coverage for your rig. You're going to have somebody trained within the department to work with your insurance carrier to analyze the damage of the unit. But before you even do that, you need to make arrangements, and this is whether the unit's involved in an accident or not. You need to have a working relationship with a qualified heavy truck towing company in the area that is capable of not only towing your apparatus if it broke down, you know, on a normal response, or someone that's capable and has experience without doing further damage to uplifting or righting the vehicle if it happens to be rolled on its side. You start thinking about walk-in rescue trucks. Why do you think we have kick-out windows and escape hatches put into the roofs of those things? They're not there for jokes. They're there for when the unfortunate incident happens, but you need to have somebody that's lined up to be able to do that, that's not going to do further damage, or some guy that's going to show up thinking he's going to upright your 30-ton ladder truck with a regular tow truck or a low boy. So these are some of the things you need to consider. If your department doesn't have any or all of these things in place or hasn't thought about all of these different contingencies, this is a good time to start planning those things out. Even if just a member gets hurt, how are you going to cover that, and who's going to be responsible for doing what? Our job is difficult enough in responding to incidents, doing what we can to mitigate them, hopefully make them better, maybe make the person's life a little better when we go home. When we don't even arrive safely or can't get there, we've kind of failed at the first basic premise that what the fire and emergency services is all about. So we hope that in our upcoming podcast that we're going to be doing out in San Diego and later on this year, we can be talking a little bit more about some positive and upbeat things. But given the results and the newsworthiness of what's going on here in the first 3 to 4 days of 2008, Tom Shand and Mike Wilbur really want to reach out to everyone in the fire service, wish them a very healthy and happy, but more importantly, a very safe new year, and hopefully not find ourselves on the front pages of any of these tabloids or newspapers as a result of something that we did where things didn't go well. So, Mike, any final thoughts here to wrap up today's podcast?
Yeah, Tom. Just we need to tell folks to buckle up, get over the idea it can't happen to you. There were over 50,000 emergency vehicle crashes last year in 2007, and it's happening to somebody out there. And don't think it's just going to be in a big city or at an intersection. It can happen anywhere at any time. You need to be aware. You need to slow down. You need to get there, particularly here in the north and northeast in the wintertime. You need to adjust your driving for conditions that are around you. And you need to get there safely and in one piece. And I, too, my sentiments, please have a happy and safe New Year.
If you have a comment on this program, drop us a line at radio@firehouse.com. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned to firehouse.com for more broadcasts like these. Or visit our website at www.firehouse.com/radio.